Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Oriana Resources Exploration Update conference call. My name is Josh, and I'll be your coordinator for today's conference. For the duration of the call, you will be on listen only. However, at the end of the call, you will have the opportunity to ask questions. If at any time you need assistance, please press star zero on your telephone keypad, and you will be connected to an operator. I'm now handing you over to your host, Derek McPherson, VP Mining Analysis at Red Cloud Klondike Strike Incorporated, to begin today's conference. Thank you.
Thank you, Josh. I'd like to welcome everybody to this exploration update call with Orania Resources. I have with me on the call Keith Barron, Chairman and CEO, and Richard Spencer, President and Director, both of Orania. Before we get started, I need to mention the cautionary statements, disclaimers, and disclosures. For Orania Resources, there may be some forward-looking statements made on this call. I would direct listeners to note the forward-looking statements on page 2 of Orania's corporate presentation located in the investor section of the company's corporate website. For Red Cloud Klondike Strike, Inc., please see the full disclaimer and disclosures on our most recent Orania Resources post on our Rocks Talk blog on our website, and I would highlight that this call is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation to purchase or sell securities or a recommendation to buy or sell securities. We note this call does not take into account the particular situation or needs of individual investors. Participants should rely on their own investigations and seek their own professional advice before investment. Red Cloud, specifically for Red Cloud, related to Orania Resources Corp., in the last 12 months, Red Cloud has been retained under a servicer advisory agreement by Orania. In the last 12 months, Red Cloud has received compensation for investment banking services from Orania. And Red Cloud or a member of the Red Cloud team or household has a long position in shares and or the options of Orania. The format of the call is a conversation between myself, Keith, and Richard, followed by questions from the line. We may reference Orania's corporate presentation, which, as previously mentioned, is available under the investors section of Orania's website. Keith and Richard, let's start with a brief summary of the history of Orania and the Lost City of the Kudu project. Keith, as an introduction, can you talk to us about what attracted you to the Lost Cities project in Ecuador?
Well, first of all, for the record, we're not Oriana, we're Orania. And Orania, very loosely translated, and I do mean loosely in Latin, means country of gold. And that's our objective. How did I get started on this? Well, it actually goes way, way back, 1998, when I first went to Ecuador. I actually traveled there as a tourist to improve my Spanish. Ended up living with a family of Ecuadorians headed by a history professor by the name of Octavio Latorre. And Octavio had actually worked for the mines department at a very, very curious project back in the early 80s. He had, after a place called Nambija had been rediscovered by accident by two boys hunting in the forest. It was an old mine of the Spanish conquistadors that had been abandoned in 1603 after a smallpox epidemic. Then reclaimed by the jungle. Anyway, what happened was that these two boys who were out hunting found a tunnel, went home, told their father, and within 1 month there were 25,000 miners there mining high-grade gold. The place on the record ended up producing 2.7 million ounces, and the government said, boy, you know, we know that there are other ones existing out there, and if we could find them and really secure them for the government, then we could vend the rights to companies like Homestake and Placer Dome, big gold companies that were existing at the time. So they employed Professor Latorre and a couple of other chaps to go through all the records, all the archives within Ecuador, looking for places. And they actually found a number of them, large number. And when I met Professor Latorre in 98, he said to me, Keith, you know, there were seven very famous mining areas in what is now the country of Ecuador. One of them was never lost. The other six have gradually been found over time, refound, after they had been abandoned. But the last two are still missing. One of them is called Logroño de los Caballeros. The other one is called Sevilla de Oro. And they were both regarded at the time in contemporary documents to be the richest places in the Spanish Empire. in all the Spanish possessions. And the professor had a lot of information to back this up. He had maps, contemporary maps. He had lots and lots of reports out of the archives. Anyway, to cut a long story short, because it is a long story, we ended up working together for a period of about 10 years. And the historical work, the records that we collected, guided a land selection of 208,000 hectares in what is called the Curicú, the Cordillera de Curicú, in southeastern part of Ecuador, which is just to the north of where Richard and I had worked for many years in the Cordillera del Condor to the south. The Cordillera del Condor is heavily explored. There are three copper mines in pre-production right now. Fruta del Norte, which was a gold discovery made by my previous company, Aurelian Resources, is being built right now by the Lundin Group, Lundin Gold, and that should be in production by the end of 2019. So anyway, we put together a package of 208,000 hectares, and that is our focus right now, and this is what we've been exploring.
Gentlemen, last week you released your first results from ground exploration. Can you give us the key takeaways from that work?
I think the key takeaway was that we've started to see a signature of that's typical of epithermal gold-silver deposits. Keith's prior company found the 14-million-ounce Fruta del Norte gold discovery or deposit in the adjacent area to the south, and we're in our target area in the Lost Cities Cotoco project starting to see exactly the same chemical signature that was characteristic of Fruta del Norte. And more importantly, and this is something that's difficult to get over in a press release, is the textures in the rock that we're seeing. We're seeing very high level rocks in those systems, and so that's sort of defining the target area on the so-called La Torre project.
You've identified two targets to date. One from geophysics, the Alacha target, and one from geochem results, the La Torre target. With respect to the epithermal La Torre target, why does this remind you of Fruta del Norte?
Well, Fruta del Norte was found as a stream sediment anomaly, and then when it was investigated, there were chunks of what's called chalcedonic quartz that were found in the field. There were boulders and then eventually outcrops, places where it was actually sticking out of the ground, were found by the geologists. Now, that area doesn't have much gold at all on surface. In fact, virtually none. And reason being, the ore body is about 125 meters down. It's blind, does not come to surface. But what does come to surface is what's called a bleed zone. This is very late stage epithermal, geothermal system, really kind of the last gasp of the whole thing. And it came to the surface and precipitated the quartz, the chalcedonic quartz, which has large contents of arsenic, antimony, and mercury in them. These are naturally occurring mercury, and these are what are called pathfinders for gold, which could be gold or silver that could be at depth. So we found a similar sort of signature that was found in the very, very earliest work that was done at Fruta del Norte by Aurelian. So we found elevated levels of arsenic, antimony, mercury, thallium, and a couple of other things that are considered to be pathfinders. And we're finding blocks of epithermal quartz, so epithermal vein quartz, and also stuff that breccias, stuff that had obviously been blown apart by things like geysers and geothermal activity. And this is very, very got us very, very excited because this is certainly the sort of thing that's found in Fruta del Norte and similar sorts of targets all around the world. The Awacha target is another target that we've been talking about. Now, that's found by geophysics, so we did fly our entire land package, the entire 208,000 hectares, with magnetometer and radiometric survey. And the Awacha targets it's not just one target, it's actually a group of about 10 anomalies which are all magnetic. And they're about the same shape and size as the stuff that SolGold has found just to the north of Quito in another part of the country. So we've got a couple of lookalikes here. What we need to do is get on the ground and what we call ground truth these things, investigate them and see what they are. But certainly they've got us very excited as well.
And I think one of the other takeaways from the Awacha target is that not only is it very similar to SolGold's deposit, but or the geophysics is, but the geophysical signature is very similar to the San Carlos copper deposit, which is just in the same belt, just contiguous to our concession area, and the Pananza and Mirador porphyry coppers and porphyry copper golds. And those are in the same belt. And they stick out really well in the geophysics because their core is typically about a kilometer in diameter. They're typically relatively round. And our geophysical survey was designed so that the helicopter would fly over a typical core at least 2 to 3 times. And that way we can define these magnetic cores, and they come out to these deposits, and they come out very, very distinctly on the geophysics. Whereas the kind of epithermal targets that Keith was talking about previously, and of which Fruta del Norte is a great example is being developed at the moment, those don't come out all that strongly in the geophysics. It's particularly good at finding the porphyry copper and copper gold deposits.
One of the questions we get a lot from investors is when you guys expect to start drilling. So maybe talk a little bit about the when you expect to start drilling and what the steps are that you're going to take to get there.
Well, we're having been in this exploration business a long time. We're very cautious about sort of blowing our wad once, so to speak, in terms of drilling the first target. Our plan is to get something between sort of 4 and 6 targets lined up, and then to do the exploration drilling, maybe 1,500 meters. Or so 3 to 5 holes on each one of those targets. And that would be a purely exploration drilling to give us a feel for which is the best of those 4, 5, 6 targets. And that is a wise way of reprioritizing those targets and ensuring that we are likely to focus on the best targets. I think all of us in the exploration industry have been in situations where we've ended up drilling a target that looks really good, and it in fact at the end of the day isn't the best target, and we're trying to mitigate that by taking our sort of cautious approach. And the idea would be to drill in the second half of 2018.
Obviously, the Kudu project is very large. What work is ongoing to develop those additional targets that you're looking for?
Well, we've got the advantage of the geophysics that has covered the whole area. We've highlighted the Awacha target as being a sort of porphyry copper or porphyry copper gold target. But one thing that we've got to reiterate is that target represents only 3% of the entire land package. So we are likely to see many, many more targets out of the geophysics. And then the stream sediment work, which is a very sensitive exploration method, and particularly in that environment where the streams are pretty steep and they're flowing quickly, It's a very sensitive method for picking up not only gold deposits or gold mineralization, but base metals as well. So we've got those two things. The geophysics is already done, and the geochemistry of the stream sediment samples will be going on probably until the mid next year sometime. Keith?
Yeah, well, that's very well stated. You know, I want to make it clear that when we say that we're going to drill four or five targets, this is not going to be it. We expect that over time there's going to be many, many, many targets, many more than the four or five that are generated by this work. To date, we've done stream sediments only on about three concessions out of the existing 42. So there's lots of room for expansion here. And there's lots of time for good news to be coming down the pipe.
And perhaps, obviously, Ecuador has really started to heat up over the last several months even. Perhaps you could talk about what it's like to work in the country, and I guess what you guys have seen as changes that you've seen recently.
Well, I think that the biggest change recently. Well, two of them. First of all, Lundin Gold getting the exploitation permit on Fruta del Norte. Now they're actually underground, sinking twin declines. So this is really, really going to be transformational for the country. It'll be the first modern mining operation in the history of Ecuador. So it really is a game changer. The other thing, of course, has been the discovery by Sol Gold of the Cascabel porphyry copper gold target, and they just released a very, very good-looking maiden resource, I think it was last week. And that's attracted a lot of the majors now to the country. So we've got everybody there. Really, all the big names are in the country now. There are 28 companies now operating in Ecuador. When we started this project, I think maybe there were three or four. So it's become a little bit of the flavor of the month. And we expect that there's going to be more and better results coming just from Arania, but from other projects all around the country. It really is a transformational time.
And then maybe just looking ahead over the next few months, what news can investors expect and sort of the timing of that news as well?
Well, we've got eight field crews going, doing their work on the ground at the moment, and so there's pretty much a constant flow of both stream sediment results and rock chip results as we follow up on these various geophysical targets. You know, it's very easy to point to a geophysical map and see a red blob on it and say that one's got something interesting. So we're trying to get field teams onto those, onto the geophysical targets to ground truth them and verify that they are the right kind of rocks that we would expect to see in one of those targets. So I think there's going to be a technical news flow pretty constantly going forward from here. And just to reiterate what Keith said just now, you know, the 4 to 6 targets that we would line up for drilling towards the end of this year, that's an ongoing process. And we would be defining and reprioritizing those targets as we verify them in the field. So there's going to be news coming out of the stream sediments, the rock chip follow-up, the soil geochemistry, which just helps us to refine those target areas and helps us to set up the drill targets. And also we'll talk about the geophysics as we become more confident about it in the field. Ecuador is a pretty exciting place to be working at the moment with so much activity there, and our field teams are certainly pretty motivated.
That's great. Thank you, Keith and Richard. Josh, let's open the call for questions from the line.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad now, please. If you change your mind and wish to withdraw your question, please press star 2. Please ensure your line is unmuted locally, and then you'll be advised when to ask your question. So that's star 1 on your telephone keypad now, please. Okay, so our first question comes from the line of Patrick Larissy. Patrick, please go ahead. Your line is now unmuted.
Thank you. Congratulations, guys, on a great start to your exploration program. Just wondering, do you have an archaeological crew looking for the lost cities themselves? Are you using any remote sensing data, or is it all purely geological?
Yeah, I can answer that. We considered using LIDAR, which has been used recently to find stuff in Central America, but it's not going to work here because the jungle is too thick. However, we know, certainly I know from my past experience with Aurelian, that the stream sediment work is very, very sensitive, and if anybody at any time historically was working upstream and putting tailings or just disturbing stuff upstream, you will pick it up in the gold results. So when we did it on the Aurelian property, we found a Spanish tunnel. We know that it was Spanish because you could see chisel marks made in the walls by steel, and certainly the natives in Ecuador didn't have anything that was harder than bronze. So we're relying on the stream sediment work, and I can tell you these things won't be able to hide. We know that Sevilla de Oro and Logroño were both producing gold on and off for about 35 years, so there should be a signature in the surrounding streams. But thank you for your question.
Thank you.
But in fact, also you've done an enormous amount of work on the old maps and the old descriptions of how to get to both Logroño and Sevilla, and people have been working in the background on using the old maps and river names and descriptions of as to how to get to those areas on the modern maps, and so there's a reasonable idea as to where those two areas are.
Josh, do we have any other questions from the line?
Okay, so we have no further questions on the line at the moment, so please be reminded, if you would like to ask a question, it's star 1 on your telephone keypad now, please.
Perhaps while we're waiting for people to queue up, I'll ask a question. Keith and Richard, can you maybe talk about your experience in Ecuador? Both of you have rich histories and have made previous discoveries there.
Richard. Well, yeah, I went to Ecuador in 93 for the first time with a company that was actually looking for gold, and we ended up exploring the area that's contiguous with the Lost Cities Cutuco project, and ended up being the crew was very lucky to have discovered a number of copper and copper gold porphyry deposits, three of which are in pre-production at the moment. I think we discovered about 25 billion pounds worth of copper. But the crucial thing was that we were living literally with the guys in the field in two-man tents over a period of 3 years in the jungle. It was pretty tough work, but incredibly rewarding, and that gave us a pretty unique insight as to who the local people were, and allowed us to establish a good sort of understanding of the people in the region. And subsequent, I originally went to Ecuador on a one-year contract and ended up staying there for 10 years. After the 3 years with Gencore, I moved across to IAMGOLD, and we were lucky enough to make an epithermal discovery, which is now called Loma Larga, and that's also in pre-development. But in fact, on a more sort of personal level, Our two kids were actually born in Quito and Ecuador, so we've got as a family got a long history there and very good memories, and I'm delighted to be working back there.
And myself, Keith here, I made my first trip in 98, and then I went back in 2000 specifically to see the professor again. And he convinced me in July of 2000 to actually set up a new company and do exploration in Ecuador. So he introduced me to a number of the people in the governments and found me legal representation. And then towards the end of 2000, I spent a month in the Library of the Geological Survey of Canada and a month in the Library of the USGS in Reston, Virginia, looking up everything that I could on Ecuador, not just geology, but geography, everything about the people, the political system, everything I could find. And so I read voraciously through all this stuff and then determined to go there right after New Year's in 2001 and decided to kind of do a reconnaissance of the three known gold provinces, El Oro, Zamora Chinchipe, and Loja. And lo and behold, on that that trip, actually made a gold discovery, and that became the crux for land position that eventually became 96,000 hectares.
All right, Josh, looks like we have a couple more questions from the line.
Okay, our next question comes from the line of Alfred Lenarkiak. Apologies for the pronunciation there. Please go ahead. Your line is now unmuted.
Okay, good afternoon. I'm Alfred. Thank you, Keith and Richard, for the description of your project, which encouraged us to invest, follow and invest. My question is, please, specifically a bit about the market structure, because lately, you know, you stocked more than double, and your financial projections and next financing round, or how you're going to finance your exploration program, which looks like would be substantially, you know, long and expensive.
Alfred, thanks very much for the question. You know, we are part of the last financing, which was done in April, May this year, included a half warrant at the strike price is $3. And since the share price is appreciated, we're getting a reasonable amount of interest in the exercising of those warrants. And if all of the stock is if all of the warrants are exercised, that would bring in another sort of 4.5 million or so, and that will certainly fill our needs for the sort of immediate future. So we're more or less on target with where we expected to be. So when the in terms of expenditure, and so when that original raise of $6 million was done, April, May 2017, it was sort of planned to have those warrants exercised. So we're pretty much where we need to be in the short term. And then, you know, as we progress and as we start to get more color on the specific targets, we'll think about a raise.
And I might just add, our structure is pretty tight. So we've got just under 30 million shares currently out and around 32 million fully diluted. And that is the intention. We intend to keep this thing tight along the way. I don't want to see a lot of cheap paper pushed out on this. And so when we do eventually do a raise, it's going to be at a higher price than the last one. This is certainly the modus operandi that we had with Aurelian, and one of the reasons when We eventually did find a nice big deposit with that company. We were able to reward the shareholders so much, so well, because we kept that structure nice and tight. So that is our intention. And you know, this story is going to be driven by results. So we're going to have results, I think, more or less continuously from the field now. And that is what's going to drive the story here. Thank you for your question, Alfred.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Mark Fields. Mark, please go ahead. Your line is now unmuted.
Thank you. Hello, gentlemen. You've talked quite a bit about the work on the historical Spanish mines, the gold mines, which you've basically done a lot of research on, both through archives as well as the geology now as well. And those are both very exciting targets. One of the targets that really intrigues me is the porphyry copper potential there as well. You've done the geophysics now to help zero in on some of those targets. Could you comment a little bit more on the geophysics you have done and how you'd follow up on those porphyry targets in the ground and how deep they might be?
Do you want to?
Mark, yeah, we've started checking some of those geophysical targets, and your question is an outstanding one, because of course when you end up with a red blob on a geophysical map, you have no idea of what depth that magnetic signature is coming from, and that's one of the reasons that we sort of held our breath for a couple of months as the geophysical data were coming in. Without getting ahead of ourselves, and we expect to have a press release on this in due course, all I can say is that we're seeing in the field the kind of rocks that we would like to see over one of those red blobs. Sorry, that's a bit obscure, but otherwise I'm getting ahead of myself and I'll get into trouble. But let me rephrase it. Let me just say that our concern about the causative magnetic body being too deep to be of potential sort of economic interest, from what we've seen so far, that is not going to be an issue.
And I might add, it really does appear that the Curicó Cordillera is not as deeply eroded as the area to the south, the Cordillera del Condor. If you look at the geological maps that are on our website, you'll see that the Cordillera del Condor has a lot of granite batholith exposed. So that has been eroded almost right down to its roots. Up to the north where we are in the Curicó, that hasn't happened. A lot of the volcanic edifice is intact. So that means two things. First of all, we're hopeful that if and when we do find some porphyry coppers, that the chalcocite blanket, the supergene blanket, if you like, will be preserved on these things. That's just a hope at this point. We don't have any hard information, but that's really our one of our expectations. The second thing is that on the area to the south in the Cordillera del Condor, there's gold in virtually all the creeks and streams, and that's because the epithermal vein deposits have been completely eroded right down to the roots. They don't exist anymore. The only remnants is the gold that's left in the streams. Up in the Curicó, though, because the erosion level has not been as deep, we're expecting that these things are going to be largely intact, so that's great for us. And certainly, the early information that we're finding with the rock samples that are coming out of, and we've got this on our website and in our last press release, showing very, very high level epithermal stuff has been certainly it's still around. It's preserved. So that's a really significant plus for us.
And Mark, just to go on from that, I mean, as Keith says, in the Cordillera del Condor adjacent to us, the magma pool that was at depth, which drove the porphyry systems and epithermal systems that were sort of like pimples above that pool. That is now been eroded, and that's exposed on surface. And one of the biggest things that came out of the geophysics, which was a surprise to us, although we'd suspected it, it was fantastic to see it, is that we've got a geophysical signature that there is one of those batholiths in our area, right over the core of our area. So there was a similar magma pool at depth. And so the mechanism and the heat and the source of metals and everything that one would need in an exploration district or a district that's going to have a lot of deposits in it, that magma pool that would drive that exists. And that was unknown from prior to our geophysics. And we covered it a little bit in one of our prior press releases. And then one of the other things, just to follow on what Keith was saying, in the porphyry discoveries that were made to the south, San Carlos and Pananza and Mirador, those systems eroded quite deeply. So there is no secondary enrichment blanket. And as in the Chilean and Peruvian deposits, it's normally that secondary enrichment of copper that actually makes those deposits work from an economic point of view. In the area adjacent to us, there's one deposit that has got part of that secondary copper blanket preserved, and that's called Huarinza. And we believe that our porphyry copper targets will indeed have a secondary blanket, a secondary copper blanket preserved on them. That's one of the reasons that we're excited, that we were excited about starting to explore in that area.
Thank you, gentlemen. Very thorough responses. It's certainly one of the very exciting parts of the program. I find we've got multiple targets of both epithermal gold and porphyry copper. It's a very exciting project. Good luck with it.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay, our next question comes from the line of Nicholas Lapin. Nicholas, please go ahead. Your line is now unmuted.
Hi. My question was actually answered in the previous one. I just was in the queue.
Okay, thank you very much. Our next question comes from the line of Ronald Shaw. Ronald, please go ahead. Your line is now unmuted.
Thank you. Does the archival search still persist in places like the Spanish libraries or the Vatican Library? And what is the closest you've come to any locational indicators? Have you run across any letters or maps from people in the government who were involved in the exploitation of Ecuador in Spain, or any of the sailors or whatever that went there? Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. Keith here. I was working with Professor Octavio Latorre for more than 10 years on this in all kinds of different archives. We were at the British Library, at New York Public Library, the rare book section, in Lima, Peru, at the library of the Catholic Diocese. We were also at every conceivable archive you could think of in Ecuador. Most of our information, though, came from the General Archive of the Indies in Seville, Spain. And Seville used to be the capital of the Spanish Empire. And all the records from the Spanish territories, including the Philippines, were all moved to this one building in 1785 by order of the king. So that stuff is, it occupies, there's 40,000 documents, there's 2 million pages of documents. It's a fantastic archive. We had two archivists working on it for about a year and a half together with a professor, and I think we pretty much exhausted everything that we could find. The only things that we haven't been through are accountancy records, specific accountancy records, and those are actually, believe it or not, they've never been digitized, and they're still, they're like baled up like cotton bales. All these parchment documents still are tied up and sitting in a storeroom somewhere, and they still need to be opened and conserved. Unfortunately and very sadly, Professor LaTorre left us several months ago. He died at the age of 87, and it's very sad that he's not around to witness what's going on now. But I think we really exhausted most things. Really, one of the most significant documents that we found was in the Vatican Library in the manuscript section, and it's a book that was written in 1628 and 1629 by a Carmelite priest. His name was Antonio Vasquez de Espinoza, and he lived in the New World for 22 years. And actually, he gives a description in one of the chapters of how to get to Sevilla de Oro from the town of Riobamba. Riobamba is not moved. It still exists. And in one of our videos that's on the Internet, we talk about following the conquistador trail. And that's basically the trail that was mentioned by this Carmelite priest. It pretty much nails down where it is, and we know that Logroño de los Caballeros, which was kind of the sister gold camp, was one day's walk due south from there, so more or less 20 kilometers. Now, I'm not going to say specifically where I think these things are, but I think we've got them nailed within about 5 kilometers. So pretty specific information.
So nothing has come about since that would change your mind regarding whether you're still within 5 kilometers of a good guess?
Well, you know, we're working through the material, the land package, and of course, some of it's got better access than other places. There's one area where the local indigenous population do not go, and when our chief geologist asked a couple of the locals why they don't go there, they said there's two reasons. There are too many jaguars and there are tuyas. Well, we know what a jaguar is, and I'm not particularly afraid of them. Actually, I've seen them in the jungle and they just run off. They're quite scared of people. But a tuya, I didn't know what it was, and I had to have it explained to me. And it means a kind of an evil an evil spirit. And the locals say that these live in caves. I'm not particularly afraid of evil spirits, but the geologist in charge, Jean-Paul Pellier, is very, very excited about this because potentially these caves are actually old mines of the Spaniards. So this is an area that we will be getting into very early in 2018. And as I've said early on this broadcast, there is no way that these things can hide from the stream sediment sampling. If they're there, and we know because there's like 50 years worth of archival documents that exist, we know that these places existed. We know that they're real. It's just a question of finding them. So, but as Richard has said, this is an area that has got great potential, not just for gold, but for porphyry copper. And it's our intention to explore the entire belt. We're not treasure hunters. We're not just looking for historical stuff, though it'll be a hell of a nice bonus to find the lost cities.
Thank you. Very clear explanation.
Thank you.
Okay, our next question comes from the line of Alfred. Please go ahead. Your line is now unmuted.
Thank you. Thank you for the statement that you are not treasure hunters. However, my question is, as you remember, Nambiha, when it was discovered by the boys going to the caves. If you expect to go somewhere in the future to those caves, etc., how you are protected from eventual invasion of the local illegal miners? And the second question is, will you continue to do your quite entertaining but informative also the video kind of releases, which can be easy transformed and sent to the potential shareholders and shareholders?
Alfred, thanks. I'll leave Keith to talk about the videos. In terms of invasion, if we do discover something, I think that was the reason that this whole project was actually set up. The disaster that happened at Nambiha. Not only did the government not get much revenue from it because the gold was all taken by informal miners, but it is an environmental disaster. The miners used mercury to recover the gold, and I believe it's one of the most contaminated or areas most contaminated with mercury in the world, which is a horrible legacy to leave behind. So the government has learned from that. That's the whole reason that they started with Professor Latorre starting to look into these historic areas, because they didn't want a repeat of Nambiha. And so that from a government level, we will get an enormous amount of support from the government level. But on the level of the local communities, we have a very good relationship with the communities in which we're working, and that's one of their concerns as well, that this kind of thing doesn't happen. And they have indicated to us in no uncertain terms that they will not let their land be overrun with informal miners, and they always point to Nambiha as a nightmare scenario. So we have support from the local communities, and we have support from the government level as well.
And addressing the videos, the reason that we started the videos, actually, Professor Latorre very sadly had Parkinson's disease, and it eventually claimed his life, but he had it for 5 years, and he was starting to lose the ability to speak. And we really wanted to capture him on camera speaking for legacy purposes. His family very much wanted this to happen. He wanted it to happen. And so we filmed about 20 hours of video with him speaking, and some of that is ended up in our videos that are on YouTube and on our website. They're tremendous fun, and we're going to continue them. Part of why we're doing it, we want to educate people. You know, it's almost like what we do in exploration is like one of the dark arts out of Harry Potter. You know, it's not something that's very complex. We want to underscore that exploration is not like buying lottery tickets. It is guided by people who have spent a lot of time in university studying these things, and there's real hard science behind it. So this is the reason why companies, big companies and small companies, have exploration staff. And we want to be absolutely transparent with what we do. And I think it's great fun for our investors to follow along and see how we do things in the field. We've got two videos very close to being released. And I might add, and this is actually a lot of fun for us, We just got approached recently by a major network. I don't know what is ever going to come out of that, but we'll see. You know, it's fun stuff. Anyway, but thank you for your question, Alfred.
Thank you for clear response, and I wish that La Torre targets would be the one.
Okay, so we have no further questions on the line, so I'll hand back over to your hosts.
Thank you, everyone, for your questions, and thank you, Keith and Richard, for taking the time to explain Orania's projects. It's been a very informative call. If any of the participants on the call have follow-up questions, please don't hesitate to contact myself, Orania, or your Red Cloud representative, and we'll be happy to get the answer you're looking for. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for joining today's call. You may now replace your handsets.